You all like to sing here, don't you? Great singing. Love to be a part of this. And I always think when I do these things that I get more out of them than I give. I try to do my best to give you something of value on occasions like this. But got to eat with Jack and Allison, some others tonight, and some Hamiltons, known their family forever and ever. I preached to Allison when she was a teenager down in Tustin, and now her kids are grown. Just can't be possible. Casey Blake is with us tonight, known him for a long, long time. And mentioned several preachers being in the group yesterday, and failed to mention John Trokey. He's also just one more of many. That's intimidating. But what's really foolish is trying to speak on the Middle Ages and Rich Maurer is around. So I don't know if I'm bold or just a fool to get up here and address this with so many other experts out there. But I'm thankful for the opportunity, thankful to be with this fine church this week. And you really do give me the fuel that keeps me going. And so thank you for the opportunity. We talked yesterday about the whole idea of the text being copied. The idea of a manuscript is a hand-copied document. And the idea that we don't have the autograph originals, we don't have the master copies, and there are some that would automatically discount everything because we have copies of copies and so on. And we made some comparisons. The New Testament compared to everything else. And Homer would be in second place in terms of numbers of manuscripts. But do you know how many original manuscripts of Homer exist? I'll give you one guess. Zero. Shakespeare died in 1616, a little over 400 years ago. You know how many plays that he wrote that still exist in the autograph original? I'll give you one guess. Zero. Not even a couplet written in his own hand. And yet no one would, in spite of questions about exactly who Shakespeare was, no one would say Hamlet should be banned from theatrical productions just because we don't have the autograph original manuscripts. To give you another illustration, if Aunt Martha had this wonderful cookie recipe and it was in her head, and finally, before passing away, she scribbles it out on an index card and gives it to a niece. And the niece makes some nice handwritten copies for each of her sisters and for all of their children. Just because Aunt Martha dies and the original index card is lost does not mean that Aunt Martha's cookie recipe no longer exists. It exists in many copies that can be traced back to the original. And I would argue that the case for the legitimacy of the biblical text is infinitely stronger than that. I want to talk a little bit about the Middle Ages tonight and what the Bible was doing during that period. And I have an interest in history, certainly not an expert, but certainly an interest in church history, and I want to really focus on the biblical text during that period. We talked a little bit about Bart Ehrman last night and the shots that he's taking at the text, particularly in the two books on the right, Misquoting Jesus and Forged. And he ultimately admits in a moment of honesty, if his mentor Bruce Metzger and he were put in a room and asked to hammer out a consensus statement on what the New Testament original actually said, there would be very few points of disagreement, because the implication is that it can be reconstructed. The text can be reconstructed. And there are a few variants of significance. The end of Mark 16, John chapter 8, the woman caught in adultery, the confession of the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts 8, and a few others. But more often than not, they are extremely minor. The addition of a word, the subtraction of a word, an honest mistake by a scribe, a spelling differentiation. 2 Peter 1:1, do you spell Simon Peter's name one way or another way? And when you translate either one, it's still Simon Peter. And this is one that could be 50-50, I'm not sure, but it doesn't amount to a hill of beans ultimately. And when I read church history and I look at spellings for John Wycliffe's last name or William Tyndale's last name, there are all kinds of variations even then in the 1300s and the 1500s. And so it should not surprise us that there would be such variations in the ancient text. When I study those ancient manuscripts, particularly in the first few centuries after the formation of the church in the apostolic age, and you're looking at the second, third century and so on, viewing the writing materials as artifacts, codex versus scroll, we talked about that last night, the writing style, the individual scribes, pinpricks that helped with line justification and the neatness of the writing style and so on, line counts, corrections by editors, sacred names with the horizontal bars that we talked about last night, the little marginal doodles at the end of a book especially. Line count, let's just look at that one just very briefly. Stichoi in the Greek. Here is one manuscript that dates from the 5th or 6th century. And you have a bunch of names of Old Testament books, and then you have the numbers next to them and Genesis 4,500, Exodus 3,700. Those are line counts, and they amount to a professional scribe tallying up how much he has written, and he would get paid so much per line. And someone had to foot that bill. That's another issue. But some of these manuscripts were definitely written by professionals, and you have evidence of it right there. We looked at this last night, a marginal comment in the Codex Vaticanus, and a later editor corrects a previous editor and says, "Fool and knave, can't you leave the old reading alone and not alter it?" At least in the early centuries, and especially in the early centuries, you have a hyper concern for getting the text copied correctly with total accuracy. And that continues, even though I think there's at least a case that can be made that as the centuries pass, the scribes are possibly not quite as careful as they were in earlier centuries. But my favorite example of trying to correct a mistake comes from a medieval manuscript where they realize that they've missed a word, or that the scribe has missed a word, and it's a beautiful manuscript, and you don't want to start from scratch after you missed a word, but how do you correct that? So this is what you do. You get an animal and a human being, and you transport the word to where the man is pointing, and so that the word can be transplanted in its proper place. But even then, you don't want to miss that key word. Again, respect for biblical authority reigns supreme here. You have a general tendency to be careful and respectful of the text. No additions, no deletions, no tampering, no alterations. Just copy the text as is. And a primary focus on the sacredness of the text without drawing so much attention to peripheral issues. In the earliest manuscripts, it was not style over substance. You really have a deep concern for the substance itself, the unvarnished text. And I've got several facsimiles of early manuscripts of the New Testament, and I know what to look for in some of those to make it halfway interesting for me, but if the average person were looking at these things, you'd be bored in about 1 minute, because it's just the text there in lines of capitalized words without spaces between the words. Very difficult to read. I learned to read Greek with the small letters, and you've got capitals and just straight through, run on without the spaces. Very difficult. And there are little clues here and there in that, but the earliest manuscripts aren't the most interesting things to look at. If there's one tendency that I would say that I see a little bit of as the Middle Ages proceed, it's that as hundreds and hundreds of years pass by, substance over style kind of is replaced a little bit, at least, with it's flipped. And you have style over substance. By the time you look at some of these beautiful medieval manuscripts, they weren't exactly study Bibles. They were works of art. And it's kind of like the difference between a humble building in which New Testament Christians gather together that kind of is boring, but great worship occurs there, versus a vast cathedral with the stained glass windows and all the outer trappings. And that's kind of what you see in the development of this period of time. A lot of good work is being done by those Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox scribes who are copying the text. But and we can reconstruct the text, the original text, with near 100% accuracy. And there were additional quality control measures. Again, you see them, especially in the early period, and as copies and copies of copies are being made, and the decentralization of the text is a guarantee that no one controlled the process after that. Communal reading events were widespread in the Roman Empire. And Brian Wright has written a wonderful book on communal reading and addressed this issue. But this is just one more safeguard that's not normally talked about in this context to show that the text was fluid. And I'll give you one example that he cites. You know, at the end of the 300s, the end of the 4th century, Jerome produces a new version of the Latin Bible. And we call it the Latin Vulgate. There was an older version, older Latin translation of the scriptures. So this is brand new, the end of the 4th century. And Augustine writes Jerome. And at the end of the 4th century, he writes a letter to Jerome saying that when one word differed in the Latin of Jonah 4, verse 6, from what members had been hearing read for generations, it caused a conniption in the congregation. Everyone went ballistic. That this cannot be right because he's got that word wrong. Now I want to just, you know, think about that with me for just a moment. Do you think for a moment that people could just mess with the text right and left if the whole congregation got upset over one word? Didn't happen. And again, one more quality control measure. The decentralization of the text is a guarantee that no central bureaucracy could control or alter the message. I know that in popular perception of things, there are those who think that the Roman Catholic Church just completely messed with the text during these Middle Ages. And it's just not so. They had other problems, obviously, and those problems materialized and developed. But in earlier centuries, the revealed word was primary, not the church as a validating institution, and that morphs and changes over time. As the medieval age persisted, there was a shift in emphasis to the power of the Roman Catholic Church hierarchy and away from individual engagement with the word. I think it may be a mischaracterization to call this period the Dark Ages, but you could argue that in spite of society supposedly being Christian society, that with regard to individual engagement with the Word in an independent sort of a way, these really were, in a sense, the Dark Ages in that sense. In spite of Western Europe being a so-called Christian society, the Bible was filtered through the official channels. Would you rather have pictures on a stained glass window, a passion play, an artistic rendering of a biblical scene, a page from a medieval book of hours, a Franciscan monk, a priest, and a Catholic mass? Or would you rather own a copy of the Bible as your primary means of engaging God's Word? It's an easy question for us to answer, isn't it? And there was a pent-up desire by the end of this period to get copies of the Bible into the hands of common people. I have kind of a love-hate thing going with the Middle Ages. When I think of this general period of time, it's romanticized. You've got castles, cathedrals, cobblestone streets, damsels in distress, and knights in shining armor, and the whole fairy tale world of ideas that flashes before us. And my wife, being German, we've traveled over there, visited some of the finest museums over there, and she grew up not far from that cathedral in Cologne, Germany. And it's beautiful to look at, and you walk inside that thing, and it looks like you can hardly see the ceiling. It's so high. And beautiful, ornate things to look at, eye candy everywhere. Or Notre Dame before it burned. Some years ago, this picture was taken. I have a friend in Amboise, France, so I've been in and around the Loire Valley, seen the castles there, some of them. I've even worn my warrior's hat right next to another warrior. We've been to Rothenburg in Andrea's native Germany, beautiful medieval town, walled, and just fun to look at. And they have this medieval crime museum, and it reminds me that, you know, it's just not damsels in distress and knights in shining armor, but you've got. Suppression of truth. You've got cancel culture on steroids. I sometimes get frustrated with our culture today, but I'm not sure I would want to trade places in terms of personal engagement with the scriptures. There was brutality, there were crusades, there were inquisitions. And in Rothenburg especially, they've got a medieval crime museum. And I can't imagine being subjected to some of the instruments of torture that they had there, being pulled out of joint or squeezed to the max. Or and this one's really frightening. So if you don't want to look at it, but you could just see the sheer torture that my wife is enduring there, the brutality of it all, just in intense pain. But in truth, I wouldn't want to be in this machine and go down in the dunk or sit on that nice comfortable chair. It was a brutal period in many respects. But as I look at the manuscripts, I look at the books of hours and the biblical manuscripts, and I'm especially drawn to the gospel books and to the Psalms books and to the picture books of the apocalypse. You've got a lot of those in that period where this is the Furtmayer Bible in Germany, late 1400s. Beautiful to look at, and I have a few examples of the Apocalypse, the Book of Revelation. That people were fascinated with that in that period, and artists would draw these pictures, and so beautiful things to look at. And you still had the perpetuation of translations from other languages, such as the 4th century Gothic that would have been the language probably where my wife comes from, and gospel books that are produced later on, Amiatinus, Codex Amiatinus, and supposedly Ezra the scribe next to a beautiful cabinet that contains different sections of the Bible in the cabinet. It's kind of out of place because there's some New Testament sections there, and it's supposed to be Ezra. But nonetheless, beautiful artwork. And one of the interesting books I've read about this comes from Christopher de Hamel, on meetings with remarkable manuscripts, and he suggests that some of the artwork was actually imported from books of antiquity into the Middle Ages books that of copies. Christian scribes were not only copying the biblical text, they were also copying major works of classical literature and preserving a lot of those as well. But as I look at the gospel books in particular at this time, there's one other thing that normally it never comes up in this kind of a discussion that probably should. And that is the Eusebian canons. Eusebius was a church historian in the early 4th century, and he's known for his ecclesiastical history. He preserves a lot of what happens in the first three centuries of Christianity. And he had access to a lot of texts that no longer exist. And so it's invaluable. But the other gift that he's bequeathed to the world in many respects, he came up with this idea of kind of a cross-reference system. When Christian scholars were studying Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they didn't have chapters and they didn't have verses, because those weren't there yet, how would you compare Matthew's account with Mark's account, with Luke's account, with John's account of the feeding of the 5,000? And where would you go to find this? So he came up with a system. And the system was devised the beginning of the 4th century. And there are 10 canon tables for parallel passages in the four Gospels. Table 1 contains episodes found in all four Gospels. Table 2 through 9, they contain episodes that are found in 2 or 3 of the Gospels. And table 10 contains episodes unique to one gospel. If only one of the four gospels talks about an episode in the life of Christ, then it makes table 10. And so you have these tables, and then you have marginal references that are marked to the tables. So this devised a way of kind of cross-referencing parallel accounts prior to the modern chapter and verse divisions. So when you look at some of these beautiful medieval books, gospel books, Book of Kells, I forget which one this, maybe Reichenau out Gospels, don't remember, and even in a printed text, this is 1547, a printed Latin text from Lyon, France, and you still have this, but even the Codex Sinaiticus that dates from the 4th century already has in the margin Eusebius's numbers. So, if someone were to tell you, you know what, they just completely changed these four Gospels during this medieval period. No, they didn't. Because this is, you see it over and over and over again in these Gospel books during this whole period. And so, that little number right there corresponds with Matthew 1 and the genealogical tables for Jesus Christ in Matthew 1. It's a Eusebian canon table number. The chapter and verse divisions don't come till later on. Stephen Langton is generally credited for the chapter divisions. He also had something to do with the Magna Carta, 13th century. And Robert Estienne or Robertus Stephanus had something to do with the verse divisions around 1551. There was a Greek Latin text, and prior to that, when William Tyndale, for example, cites scripture, he'll cite a chapter, and that's it, or he'll cite a chapter like Matthew 5:8, Matthew 5:B, and you have to look in the whole paragraph to find the key verse. So from 1551, you had the verses, but you didn't have the verses before that. They're not part of the sacred text. They're just a handy way of finding the reference. And so going back to this time period, John Wycliffe comes along in the 1300s and he challenges the Roman Catholic Church on some things. And I guess I should say this. Part of the impetus to create a hunger for getting away from Roman Catholicism and getting back to the purity of the Bible is corruption was rampant. They saw the immorality of the priests and the monks and so on. They saw the amount of money that was exchanged or exacted from them and becoming part of the coffers of the church. They saw the corruption, and they wanted something better, and they wanted to get back to the purity of New Testament Christianity. There were a number of heresies in the Middle Ages, and some of the things that they do are way out there, and some of the things that they say and do would resonate with us. And John Wycliffe is one of those that comes along and he leads a team of translating the Bible from the Latin Vulgate, Jerome's Latin Vulgate, into English. And there are more Wycliffe Bibles than any other legacy in writing from the Middle Ages. It's the text and not a whole lot more. You have some ornate additions by artists of later years and so on. But you have in the 1380s this text produced, and there was a second version of it. And in spite of intense efforts to ban them, burn them, and burn those who read them, copies of Wycliffe Bibles were abundant. About 20 copies of the whole Bible survive, almost 90 copies of the entire New Testament, and over 250 of single books, larger than any other medieval text in English. And David Daniel observes, these Wycliffe Bibles came with obvious care, written on vellum to last, and generally free from additional matter. Nothing to identify the translator. Nothing to identify the place of origin or date, and the silence is noteworthy. The focus would be on the text. That was revolutionary. And people ate it up. Except for some Catholics that didn't like the idea. Henry Knighton said Christ gave his gospel to the clergy and to the learned doctors of the church so that they might give it to the laity and to weaker persons according to the message of the season and personal need. But this master, John Wycliffe, translated the gospel from Latin into English, the angle, not the angel language, and Wycliffe, by thus translating the Bible, made it the property of the masses and common to all and more open to the laity and even to women. They were able to read. And so the pearl of the gospel is thrown before swine and trodden underfoot, and what is meant to be the treasure both of clergy and laity has now become a joke to both. It's a little elitist bias there, just a little. And John Wycliffe is remembered as the morning star of the Reformation. The Catholic Church tried hard to destroy his work and discredit him. Under the influence of Bishop Arundel in 1407, there was a ruling that forbade any translation of any text of Holy Scripture into the English or other language by way of book, tract, pamphlet, and that no book, tract, pamphlet of this kind be read either recently composed or at the time of the said John Wycliffe, or since then, or that in future may be composed under pain of the greater excommunication. To add insult to injury, Wycliffe's body was exhumed 44 years after his death. His remains were burned, and the ashes scattered over the stream Swift. There were persecutions, there were inquisitions, there were efforts to stamp out dissent. But Jan Hus in Czech Republic, Bohemia, would do a back to the Bible movement of his own, spurred by Wycliffe's work, and they just couldn't completely stamp it out. And in the end of the 15th century, the 1400s, you have Lollards. It's probably a word that is a derogatory word that means ranters. At least that's one thought. Who thought of themselves as kind of a network of true Christians who were trying to get back to preserve something that was more pure than what they saw in the Roman Catholic Church. And many maintained their membership in Catholicism, but they had their own illegal conventicles. They would meet at night, often late into the night, focused on memorizing Scripture in English. And it was amazing because when they read the Bible for themselves, they came to some bizarre conclusions. Really, really strange. Images are wrong. No expensive building should be endorsed. No holy days, no confession to a priest, no allegiance to the Pope, no prayers for the dead, no infant baptism, no Latin Mass. Not all of them believed all of these things, but these were ideas that were on the table all of a sudden. And for some of them, at least, no musical instruments. I have a three-volume John Fox, Acts and Monuments. You may have heard of Fox's Book of Martyrs. This is the original. And you open up the front cover, Queen Elizabeth stares at you. And I looked at, and it's hard to read, frankly. You've got this Gothic-looking font and old English words. But the same Bishop Arundel is interviewing, actually, excoriating a William Thorpe. And one of the issues that comes up during the proceedings is you people don't think that there should be instruments of music in church. No, sir. Why not? And he gives an argument I would never think to give, but I do find it interesting that he even came to that conclusion. He said, you know, when Jesus Christ came to the house of Jairus to heal Jairus' daughter and give her her life back, he put out the minstrels. I would never think to use that argument, but it is interesting to me that he even came to that conclusion after reading his Bible in English. The real game changer, as this pent-up desire for the Bible began to pop up everywhere in the 1400s and then in the beginning of the 1500s, the real game changer was a disruptive technology that occurred, again, in my wife's home country, in Mainz. Johann Gutenberg and the printing press. And that just changed the game for everybody. And we weren't supposed to take a picture of that middle one, but that's David Posey took that picture. Gutenberg, the first book that rolls off the press is Latin, the Latin Vulgate, the Bible. And Gutenberg said, you know, God suffers in the multitude of souls whom his holy word cannot reach. The religious truth is imprisoned in a small number of manuscript books, which confine instead of spreading the public treasure. Let us break the seal which seals up holy things and give wings to truth, in order that she may go and win every soul that comes into this world by her word, no longer written at great expense, by hand easily palsied, but multiplied like the wind by an untiring machine. Yes, it is a press, certainly, but a press from which shall soon flow in inexhaustible streams the most abundant and most marvelous liquor that has ever flowed to relieve the thirst of men. Through it, God will spread his word. A spring of pure truth shall flow from it. Like a new star, it shall scatter the darkness of ignorance and cause a light heretofore unknown to shine amongst men. And so those Bibles roll off the press around 1455. I think by 1514, you have the Complutensian Polyglot. That is the first printed Greek New Testament. And Erasmus prints one a couple of years after that. But it's just beautiful. It's not like those medieval manuscripts, but it's beautiful because it opened the door. And by the time Erasmus put his edition together, you now had an edition that Luther would translate from and William Tyndale for English. Erasmus, his desire, even though he remained a Catholic, I wish that these scriptures were translated into all the languages of all people, that they might be read and known, not merely by the Scotch and the Irish, but even by the Turks and the Saracens. I wish that the husbandman may sing parts of them at his plow, that the weaver may warble them at the shuttle, that the traveler may with their narratives beguile the weariness of the way. So in the 1500s, you start having printed Bibles come off the printing presses. This is, a Latin Bible from 1547. But there's this tremendous hunger to get back to the Bible and to read the Bible. And I love this next quote from the early 14th century. I used to think I had penetrated to the depths of your truth with the citizens of your heaven, until you, the solid truth, shone upon me in your scriptures, scattering the cloud of my error and showing me how I was croaking in the marshes with the toads and frogs. There would still be persecution. And sometimes people of faith who dared to dissent paid a dear price. But then there was this little thing that occurred in Wittenberg in 1517. 95 theses, presumably nailed to the castle church door there. And a reformation was launched. But one of the greatest things Martin Luther accomplished is putting the Bible back into the hands of his German people. And tomorrow night, we'll continue that story in English. It's a great story. And one of my favorites, because I love William Tyndale. Concluding observations, the Roman Catholic Church did not produce the Bible. They suppressed it. Now, scribes did copy the text, and I'm grateful for that. The hunger for the Bible in its original context was intense. And eventually, once that cork blew, there was no stopping. There's no stopping this. People were going to have the Bible in their own native languages and be able to personally engage with it, not through the intermediary of a church bureaucracy, but just themselves in the text of God's holy word. We take that so much for granted. And we have so little appreciation of what it took to get here. But we have two more sessions to build our appreciation of what it means to even be able to own a copy of the Bible in our own language. So let's end there tonight. Thank you for your kind attention. If you're subject to the invitation call of Jesus Christ and need to respond to the gospel, God has taken these great pains to be able to bequeath to us a most precious treasure. And it will only do us good if we get into the text and get the text into us and allow the text to revolutionize us. And if we do that, our whole lives will never, ever be the same. Now would be a good time to start. Let's stand and sing a song of invitation.